We interrupt this broadcast with some important news.
Let's rewind and check out the biggest news stories from this week. It's time for Taiwan This Week.
Good evening and welcome to Taiwan This Week with me, your host, Gavin Phipps. And I'm joined in the studio this evening by Michael Fahey.
Great to be here, Gavin.
And by Sean Su.
Also great to be here.
And we'll begin this week with Mainland Affairs Council Minister Chow Tai-san on Wednesday, saying the government is working to understand Beijing's intent in its decision to omit the term peaceful reunification with Taiwan from a report released at the opening of the National People's Congress in Beijing. The statement came after China's Premier Li Qiang delivered his government's working report on Taiwan during the opening of the annual meeting. Now, speaking in Beijing, Li reiterated adherence to the One China principle and the 1992 consensus, as well as his government's opposition to Taiwan independence, separatism and external interference. However, Li omitted mention of peaceful reunification in his address and instead said that Beijing wants to be firm in its pursuit of reunification. Now, it's not the first time that China has dropped the word peaceful from the said report, but it led to concerns that China could choose to take a more aggressive approach to what it refers to as the Taiwan issue. Now, the Mainland Affairs Council minister stressed that it's premature to draw immediate conclusions, and the government is collecting additional information to better understand the situation. Now, speaking on Wednesday in Beijing, Xi Jinping called for the mobilisation of patriots in Taiwan and abroad to fend off pro-Taiwanese independence efforts, and he also went on to say that such moves would advance the peaceful reunification of China. Now, that happened before the National Defence Minister on Thursday warned that China is stepping up its grey zone warfare tactics against Taiwan. Now, according to defence officials, those tactics include saturating areas around the island with balloons, drones and civilian boats. Now, the report was delivered to lawmakers and the defence ministry says that China is now carrying out multi-front saturated grey zone tactics to harass Taiwan, including increased patrols of ships and planes. The report said that China is also using this tactic to increase the burden on Taiwan's Navy and Air Force and to obscure the existence of the median line of the Taiwan Strait. The report went on to say that China is incorporating research and militia vessels in a move to disguise military activities with civilians. So, Michael, missing peaceful word and warnings from the Ministry of Defense about China's bullshy grey zone tactics.
I think it's helpful to put Li Qiang, the Chinese premier's remarks in context. He is the premier, so he's part of the Chinese state. And the National People's Congress is the supreme legislative organ of that state. His report was 20-something pages long and is something like a State of the Union report. About 15 pages of it was about how the economy isn't doing as badly as people think and what they're going to be doing to improve the economy going forward. And then sort of toward the end, there were a couple of paragraphs about Hong Kong and Macau, where things are going great, according to them. And then a couple of paragraphs about Taiwan. He did mention something about peaceful methods slightly before he omitted the keyword peaceful unification. So I think it's important to understand that the state in the PRC's function is to execute and carry out the political vision which is created by the party. Therefore, they're kind of the guys who just take out the water, as it were. Now, the very next day, Xi Jinping, who was addressing another body, which is basically a party organization or a coalition of parties, there you're seeing the party setting out the vision. And there, the word peaceful unification was there. And I think we can understand that to mean that peaceful unification is still what the party wants, and what the party wants is what's important.
I want to pull back a little further. Can we determine the accuracy of fine-combing statements from authoritarian officials to predict their future actions? And, you know, if we look at, let's say, Russia or North Korea or, well, actually even China itself, how accurate have we been just because they leave a word out or they add another word. I remember, I think in 2019, there was a lot of panic over Xi Jinping's 2019 speech when he used the word reunification 46 times, but only included the word peaceful 18 times. And then people started, you know, calculating, well, what does this mean? Well, you know, what about the year before that and the years before that? And then we're just working ourselves into a tizzy here when, you know, actions speak louder than words. And then even that has a lot of things to come. I can comment about either. So it's hard because let's not forget. Let's look at Ukraine. Ukraine as an example. In 2022, you know, Russia claimed, and they even laughed at, you know, Western powers for saying, "We're not going to, you know, do more against Ukraine. Now, this buildup is just an exercise." Inherently, the CCP has not been a very trustworthy organization. There's even lots of speculation about its truthfulness when it comes to reporting simple things like population or even the economy. So how far can you really trust any of this when we're like, oh my God, this time they didn't say the word, peaceful reunification, you know? It's too much, I think. We have to sit back I know it works so great for the news because people say, wow, tensions are rising. If I added, you know, the millions of times tensions are rising, like where's the, you know, X and Y of this chart if we're mapping out, you know, what China's going to do next? No, I do not think China's going to suddenly say, oh, we're going to invade now and we're going to televise and telegraph that in our future statements. It's just not going to happen. So I feel like this is just yet another attempt, or if they were purposeful on this, another attempt to say, aha, look, Taiwan, you had a recent elections, so you voted for the guy we didn't like, and here's some, you know, pressure on that front. And that, I think, is something that we should react accordingly with intelligence, which is, you know, it's just another bark. Let's focus on what we can actually do, and let's focus on things that are actually tangible.
Well, Sean, you're raising some really interesting questions here. We are entering an era which is very similar to the situation we had back in the 1950s and especially the 1960s when China was completely closed to the world. And there was a small group of China watchers, especially based in Hong Kong and centered around this very remarkable Jesuit Hungarian priest named Father Lazlos, who did nothing but comb through official statements and compare tiny changes in wording. And he has a number of principles for how to do this. He believed, and I think his work showed, that in this information poor or controlled environment, it does matter what the party is saying. And you can discern changes over time through careful comparison. But he also warned that you must keep in mind that they always lie. So any individual statement has to be, you know, can't be judged in and of itself. It has to be over comparison over a long period of time. I caution that kind of China watching is important because there is a kind of common sense point of view that you often hear, especially among certain Americans, which is that don't listen to anything the Chinese say, just watch what they actually do. That's actually a mistake. Of course, we need to watch their actions as well as their words and think about them carefully together. But I agree that one little statement here isn't really that significant until we put it into a larger context and think about it carefully.
I totally agree, especially when we're looking at other factors. Like if there's a longer, bigger trend, then sure, that is definitely something to look for. I feel like maybe this could be like a small notch in someone's like larger graph of what they think is happening. I do also think at the same time that there's also a lot of motivation for quote-unquote people on our side to overemphasize these actions because there is a lot of effort to fundraise and or allow the reallocation of military expenditures towards the future defense of Taiwan or in terms of deterrence capability. And of course, you know, that doesn't get greased until, you know, there's an amicable, there's a viable threat. You know, if the perception is that China's just all bluster and not, you know, all bluster and there's nothing to actually worry about, then you're not going to get, you know, some submarine component contract being, you know, approved for Taiwan or some sort of other thing, you know, expedited for Taiwan's needs. And I do see that among weapons contractors and lobbyists where they will overemphasize or not. I wouldn't want to say overemphasize that a threat. They would really highlight a threat and then to emphasize the necessity of that. So I see both sides happening. I think during the Cold War, it was quite common, especially during the Reagan administration, to really overemphasize Russian assets and weapons that they actually didn't have. And the purpose was to increase the budgets to allow for that kind of thing. And we do see that happening right now, whether or not it's true. But the fact that if Taiwan can point to these things and say, like, listen, they dropped the word peaceful reunification, this potentially means that we need to get more support for, you know, similar weapon systems for such as HIMARS, then that would this would facilitate that.
Let me just read what Li Keqiang actually said. We will promote the peaceful development of cross-strait relations, be firm in advancing the cause of China's reunification, and uphold the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. So peaceful indeed did was omitted before the word reunification, but it appeared seven words before in the same sentence. So we may be reading too much into this.
What if next year it's nine words?
Well, what's more interesting, though, is that Xi Jinping turned around the next day and used that key phrase, peaceful reunification, again. I don't want to over-ascribe subtlety, but what may be happening here is that they're just trying to confuse us about, is it peaceful unification or is it not peaceful unification? You're going to have to guess.
Yep. But Michael, of course, it is saturation with balloons and civilian boats. And of course, the defense minister on Thursday came out and said, well, he doesn't want to start an arms race, but there's now serious concern about a first shot being fired. And if you believe the China Times, he's not sleeping very much at the moment.
He said he wasn't sleeping well under questioning during the legislature yesterday. What I was most impressed by Minister Cho's remarks, though, and actually assured, was that he very clearly drew the parallels between what the gray zone tactics that China has been using extensively for several years now against the Philippines and linked them directly to what's happening in Taiwan and specifically Jinmen. I hadn't seen any discussion of that in the hundreds of articles that have been written about what's going on in Jinmen and more generally around Taiwan. And I was relieved and assured to see that our Minister of Defense is looking at the situation regionally, globally, and strategically. I was impressed.
Yeah, I feel like this is why I think in the last election there's been a lot more I guess focus on the DPP, precisely because it's deemed in Taiwan that they are a little bit better at this, and to add further to that, I do think that this has there's a backlash effect for China behaving this way in the bigger picture of things. If they want to talk about peaceful reunification, this is not the way to do it. You know, especially if they want to convince the Taiwanese people to either join China in a bloc or Asia to join China in a bloc. These kind of tactics by saying, you know, dropping a word here and there and potentially, and then, you know, doing balloons, the oversaturation of news. And I mean, if we covered every single it's not even covered every day in the news for the wider context for people that are outside of Taiwan listening to this. It happens so often, we don't cover every single last Chinese jet that flies over the median line. It's not
anymore.
Not anymore,
I know, because of course the Ministry of Defense was doing that originally.
Yes.
But now, when it was naming every type of fighter jet, every type of bomber that would cross the come close to the median line of the Taiwan Strait or enter one of Taiwan's air defense identification zones. But of course, they stopped doing that now. And now they just say 14 aircraft. Seven of which crossed the median line, one of which entered an air identification zone.
Yes.
But it's really important to pull back a bit and realize what happened in Jinmen. Whether that boat was purely an accident, Taiwan has interdicted something like 2,000 similar vessels that don't have ship names on them, registration papers, or flags over the last 3 years. Whether that was intentional or it was just another one, China has used this to now start putting its Coast Guard around and sometimes even in Jinmen's restricted waters. This is exactly what they did in the Philippines, and it's highly significant incremental move in these gray zone tactics. And Taiwan has every reason to be worried about it. And it raises huge questions about whether Taiwan can defend Jinmen and Manzhou, whether it should, whether there should be some kind of organized evacuation, or for purposes of morale, Taiwan should expend enormous amounts of blood and treasure in a foolish sacrifice to protect Jinmen, which cannot be protected. Very difficult questions have been raised by this, and the legislators and the minister are right to be very concerned about this.
Indeed, and we will see the ramifications very soon. And unless I believe Taiwan puts down and actually follows by specific procedures, if it waffles on these things, then China will continue its gray zone tactics, because that's exactly what worked against the Philippines. And we will see the same results that will happen with Jinmen, of course.
Absolutely.
And of course, talking about the Jinmen affair, well, this week, the two families of the two Chinese men who died in the incident when the speedboat capsized, after in a collision with the Taiwan Coast Guard patrol boat, they left Jinmen after refusing financial consolidation packages from the Coast Guard administration. Now, apparently, Chinese officials continued to make demands, according to the Coast Guard administration, that were not compatible to or complied with Taiwan's legal system. Now, the director of the Coast Guard's Jingmen Matsu Penghu branch told reporters after the latest round of negotiations on the Jingmen incident broke down that the two sides will keep their lines of communication open. Now, the case is still being investigated by the Jingmen District Prosecutor's Office. And on Monday of this week, the Coast Guard administration announced that it had handed over audio recordings of the February 14th fatal capsizing. Now, also this week, lawmakers were meant to be debating a report about the Jinmen incident. Well, they clashed rather verbally and rather loudly over the naming of the said report. Now, the Legislative Internal Administration Committee invited Ocean Affairs Council Minister Guan Biling to deliver said report on what it referred to as the Jinmen boat ramming case, law enforcement procedures that led to the capsizing and follow-up. However, when submitted to lawmakers ahead of the hearing, its name had been revised to read Report on the February 14th, 2024 accident that occurred while expelling a Chinese speedboat. Now, KMT lawmakers accused Guan Biling of pressuring the Coast Guard over the report's name, which they said was changed without permission in an act of disrespect to the legislature. Now, Guan responded to that accusation, saying she supported the move to change the title because a boat collision and ramming are not the same thing. And she went on to say that boat ramming is the term that China would most likely use for what happened. So, Michael, the Chinese families so far rejecting any financial compensation, but the Coast Guard saying we hope negotiations will continue while lawmakers argued over the wording of a report.
Well, at this point, there's no compensation on the table because the legal process allocating liability and damages has not been completed
yet and won't be for some time. What Taiwan is trying to do is to offer them a gratuitous payment, presumably to help them cover funeral travel costs and as a gesture towards their undoubted pain and suffering at the loss of their family members. For whatever reasons, perhaps because the amounts are not enough, perhaps because they're afraid they won't get other compensation if they accept it, perhaps under orders from their PRC handlers, the families have not accepted that money for reasons that don't seem very clear. What's more important is that the Chinese negotiating side has put forward completely unfeasible and unlawful demands, such as the immediate return of the vessel and the bodies of the crew members. That's impossible because those are key parts of the evidence that the prosecutors are investigating in order to decide whether excessive force was used in this law enforcement exercise or not. And Taiwan is absolutely right not to be returning them and to be rejecting these frankly ridiculous demands.
Of course, the other ridiculous demand we could say was when China actually wanted the Coast Guard guys on the patrol boat to be sent to China for questioning.
Yeah, that was also absurd. I mean, what that has to do is, of course, China's view that Jinmen, Manzhou, Taiwan are all China's internal matters, and therefore their legal processes should be used to determine liability and damages. And so they want these people to go there to be the Coast Guard members to go there to be witnesses. If Taiwan were to do something like that, it would admit that it has no judicial sovereignty over events that occurred a few kilometers off the shore of Jinmen, which would simply admit what the PRC is claiming, which is that Taiwan has no sovereignty. So there was no way Taiwan could agree to any of these demands.
I find the entire situation problematic. First, I want to point out that Jinmen is susceptible to China just by water alone. The vast majority of Jinmen's freshwater is dependent on China. For example, 73% of the daily water supply is from the PRC. So, yes, basically Jinmen is indefensible. And if they put their foot down on this situation, it doesn't work. But let me reframe the context in another way. So imagine if you have two states that are side by side. Maybe, I don't know, thinking of like Italy and some other country nearby.
France.
Okay, sure. So some guy on a French scooter illegally drives into Italy, then starts perhaps gray zoning, swerving around, beeping around this freight truck. Okay, and that freight truck would be, I guess, the patrol or whatever. And then at the last moment, this scooter makes a left turn accidentally, and then falls right under the front of that truck, crushing, and killing its driver. First of all, what is that scooter doing in Italy? And in this case, these boats have been used previously. I mean, there's been some fake videos that have been, well, not fake, but chronologically inaccurate, unrelated videos of similar boats, similar speed boats that China uses to harass Taiwanese Coast Guard ships. It's been done many times. And, this case, China's going to, maximize its opportunity in milking this. First of all, what is the speedboat doing around a Coast Guard vessel and chasing and not, they're in someone else's waters. They're not going to admit that, but that's something that should be admitted to, right? It's kind of like if you mess around and you find out, that's kind of what happened. I feel bad that anybody died in this situation, but we've literally seen them do really reckless things in the Philippines and around all the South China Seas. And Taiwan is not exempt from that, where, these boats historically have been doing these things. There is a reason they don't fly a flag. There is a reason they're not registered.
And Sean, the thing that I find the most bizarre about this entire bizarre situation is the way that some people in Taiwan have been spinning this as if this relatively simple law enforcement action was somehow all Taiwan's fault, rather than focusing on the fact that China is the one sending unmarked speedboats over into Taiwanese waters and then using its coast guard to threaten and intimidate Taiwan. It's the victim and the aggressor are being completely reversed here. And yes, as in any law enforcement action, there are always questions when somebody dies if excessive force was used. And those are legitimate questions that hopefully will be sorted out through the process of law and the prosecutorial investigation and the judicial procedures that will follow. Yes, there's questions about why they didn't have all the cameras that they might have had, and we can hopefully fix that in the future. But it's very strange for the blue parties, which are normally so pro-law enforcement and seem to want the police to shoot every fleeing criminal, that now they're all over the police, who the Coast Guard equivalent, for supposed excessive force here, which I'm not saying there wasn't excessive force. We will find out in the due course of time when the investigation is completed.
Yeah. And Sean, obviously, several rounds of negotiations have broken down. But do you think the longer this takes, where is the ball? In whose court is the best ball, Taiwan or China's, the longer it's dragged on?
I honestly feel that this thing probably should be dragged on and they should be thoroughly investigated and they should take their time. I do agree that we definitely should have added more cameras. I don't buy the explanation that, you know, when you have these GoPro type machines that could record all sorts of sports actions, you're telling me you can't record, what happens on a boat. I mean,
But we understand that police hate turning these cameras on. And it's a constant struggle to get them to do it, and they probably failed to do it this time, and there should be discipline and fix it in the future.
It could also be backlash, because I mean, if you look at the spread 2020 footage of Taiwanese Coast Guard vessels being harassed in that way, it's also demoralizing. It looks bad. You know, it looks like they have total impunity, and then all of a sudden, okay, one of these boats perhaps linked, you know, we don't know if it's 100%, but it sounds like it's one of these ships that are used to harass Coast Guard vessels, made a turn and then, you know, fell under and therefore capsized under a larger boat. I mean, these are reckless actions. In a normal situation, these boats should not be anywhere close to each other, and there's no way a larger Coast Guard vessel can actually catch up to a speedboat. It reminds me of 2001 when China, I think it was circa 2001, when China claimed their fighter jet was rammed by a U.S. reconnaissance plane, a large, unburly U.S. reconnaissance plane, ramming into a cheaper Chinese fighter jet. Why would they do that? It doesn't make any sense. But it didn't stop a lot of, you know, with China's total control of the media, from giving a large portion of its populace into believing these things, right? And in this situation, you're telling me a Taiwanese patrol boat, a Coast Guard patrol boat, was able to, you know, ram into a Chinese speedboat that is much smaller, far more nimbler? I feel like there was a mistake that happened. And that resulted in the deaths. And then now China, as usual, just like in 2001, is going to demand compensation. In 2001, they lost their fighter pilot, who recklessly, you know, got too close to a United States reconnaissance plane and crashed into it. And China milked it for all it's worth. They're going to do that here. If Taiwan takes any brash actions, like, you know, saying, oh, we're really sorry, China, and, you know, here's our apology, and you start gutting yourself in that situation, then you're going to encourage China to do it again. That's what we have to avoid.
And Michael, do you think the longer it drags on, the better it is for Taiwan, or a speedier resumption of the case would be better?
I think that the due process of law needs to be followed, and that takes time, as it does anywhere. And that's in Taiwan's interest as a country ruled by law to do that rather than being forced into sudden political deals, which China wants, because China doesn't like the operation of law. But yes, as time goes by, this matter will settle down and people will be able to look at it more objectively. And so, yes, I think more time is good.
And moving away from the cross-strait issues now, and Labour Minister Xu Ming-chun this week was forced to apologise for comments she made regarding the government's plans to recruit Indian migrant workers. Speaking during an interview late last week, Xu said the Labour Ministry will first recruit Indian workers from northeastern India because their skin colour and dietary habits are closer to those here in Taiwan. And she went on to say that Indians from the northeast are mostly Christians who are adept at manufacturing, construction and farming. And the plan is based on assessments by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Now, the comments were described as racist by some Indian news outlets, and Xu was also slammed by lawmakers here in Taiwan. Now, speaking at a legislative hearing, Xu apologised for what she called her inaccurate comments that caused misunderstandings. Now, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs issued its own apology for Xu's comments and also stressed that all workers will be treated fairly. And the Ministry of Labour, of course, that also issued its own apology, saying the minister did not mean to be discriminatory, and the ministry went on to issue the obligatory statement that the ministry will review and work to better improve communications. So, Michael, I mean, that was a bit of a gaffe, really, by the Labour minister.
It really was. The minister was on a, I believe, online interview talk show where she was doing her job of trying to sell Indian migrant workers as being good workers who would fit in Taiwan easily. And she was doing a pretty good job of it in the face of quite a bit of skepticism in Taiwan about Indian migrant workers. For example, a recent example of this was there was a major hotel chain owner was angry when the MOU was signed saying, we don't want Indian migrant workers, we want Vietnamese migrant workers, because the hotel industry is desperate to get their sector opened up for migrant workers. So I think she was trying to address that sort of thing. Now, this minister, who I think has done a great job over 4 or 5 years as Minister of Labor, you know, was a practicing lawyer for 22 years in Kaohsiung before she got into the Kaohsiung city government. And like many people in Taiwan, she has not experienced a lifetime of living in a country where there's a lot of diversity and conflicts between different groups over religion and race and that kind of thing. And she may not understand fully that comments about different ethnic groups' personal appearance are always offensive and can even be discriminatory and racist. So, for example, in Taiwan, in Taiwanese, there's a very common phrase for a foreigner, which is adoga, which refers to the relatively high and pointy noses that some European foreigners have. In different contexts, this can be highly offensive and aggressive, but it can also be affectionate and just funny at the same time. So I'm not sure what context that she was thinking of. That's why she's saying that she didn't have discriminatory intent. Nonetheless, this is a big world. India is a place with many ethnic groups, racial and ethnic differences and religious differences are a huge deal, and it was offensive, and she needs to have more international experience and avoid situations like that. Moreover, her ministry and public relations people need to learn how to write an apology correctly. It does not work to say that you didn't intend something discriminatory when you said something discriminatory and that it somehow created misunderstandings. This isn't going to cut it, basically, in the future. But I think we can, she has apologized twice now. Her ministry apologized. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs apologized. It's better that this kind of thing comes out now and that we have an honest discussion of these things before the migrant workers from India come. Maybe Taiwan even needs some, what is the phrase, diversity, inclusivity, and whatever training for some of its officials on these issues.
I do think that training is actually very poignant, especially now. The apologies claim that, you know, they weren't clear enough. I think the language is extraordinarily clear. The reality is, just a few months ago, like, there was rumors about how they were going to import, you know, hundreds of thousands of Indian migrant workers, you know, and then there was some sort of minor panic about that. And I think that the reality is, Taiwan has not had the experience to deal with demographic, potential minor demographics changes. And when that's usually a good source of racism, you know, especially if you have zero-sum beliefs that, you know, oh, you know, if you have gains for one group, it must come at a loss for another. And this is something that we have not yet dealt with in Taiwan. And then you have collective ants, right? When there's an economic issue, whatever, then you have emotional responses. I want to point out that several years ago, some village was getting they were building like a housing for temporary workers from, I think, Vietnam and other Southeast Asian countries. And then people from the town said, we didn't want rapists. And of course, there was a lot of anger throughout Taiwan about that kind of language. But it does exist because we haven't faced this issue. The language was clear. It wasn't unclear. It was a very racist language. And it stemmed about because this minister was trying to placate a populace that has people that will feel unease about, you know, migrant workers coming in without realizing that migrant workers are a huge lifeblood of Taiwan's economy. You know, they're not only helping, we have caretakers helping our elderly, we have migrant workers filling up hard factory, you know, work that no regular Taiwanese people want to do. And the reality is, with Taiwan's population issues and birth rate issues, we need them more than they need us. They don't need to choose Taiwan. They don't. They have many other countries they can choose. So we need to do better as a nation is how I strongly feel, because I feel migrant workers are doing us a favor. And this is something I feel a lot of Taiwanese friends of, you know, my fellow Taiwanese sometimes don't get or even bother to think about. So I get where, you know, the Ministry of Labor is coming from. They want to convince the populace. But this is not going to be as simple as saying, oh, yeah, we're only going to have the quote-unquote light-skinned Indians. That personally offends me, because if you look around the wider picture around the world, there are a lot of name in the major companies we have, like Microsoft is run by an Indian-American. Google is run by an Indian-American. There are a lot. Look at Silicon Valley. It's basically powered by a lot of Indian-Americans. They're great, smart people. And we are lucky to have them here. So I feel we need to change the context a little bit. And, you know, we need to point out, hey, they're doing good stuff for Taiwan. We're the winners here in this relationship. I don't know if it can be sold that way to the regular people, but I think they need to know that this is them doing us a favor in reality.
I thought one of the most interesting things that happened was that there was a Plains Indigenous legislature who really took the minister to task. It was pretty powerful. He said that it was discrimination, that Taiwan suffers from discrimination, especially against Indigenous Taiwanese who have been dealing with this for years, and society is simply ignoring it. Very interestingly, he said that the Executive Yuan has two bills to deal comprehensively with ethnic, religious, and racial discrimination that they have apparently been sitting on and not releasing, and that he himself is going to introduce his own version of the bills immediately. So this is, you know, many people in Taiwan will often say that there's no racial discrimination in Taiwan, but I fear that there is, and that it's a repressed reality that Taiwan has hitherto not wanted to face. I think it's best that we have this national conversation sooner rather than later.
Michael, interesting you brought up those two bills. Do you think Taiwan is ready for race relations-related bills?
Well, Taiwan wasn't ready for a same-sex marriage bill, but it passed. At the time that it passed, a majority of Taiwanese were against same-sex marriage. And now, just a few years later, the world has not come to an end. 66% of Taiwanese support same-sex marriage, and Taiwanese people take a fair amount of pride at being the first country in East Asia to have adopted same-sex marriage. So I think that with some leadership from politicians and other prominent people in society, it's not going to be easy. Getting rid of prejudice, as I know from my own country of the United States, is something we've never successfully done. But we have improved things, and I know that Taiwan can do better.
Oh, yeah, it's never too early to take this issue. Taiwan, just using LGBT or gay issues, that has been, Taiwan, it's been part of Taiwan's conversations for a very long time. And then it was covered in films in the 90s and 80s, and so it took a long time for this to actually sort out. So there is no fault, I think, in trying to start early on this. Koalas Yotaka, other indigenous legislators have faced racism just for their names alone. At the end of the day, Taiwan needs to face this as soon as possible.
Yeah, and I think that actually you raise an important point. I think that our indigenous brothers and sisters have a special role to play in this, to raise awareness and explain that this is happening and call it out like Kolas and like that legislator did. They said loud and clear, this was not, you didn't intend racism or you're afraid of causing misunderstandings. This was racial discrimination and it's not acceptable.
No, we should not leave any quarter, even if it at the cost of trying to convince the Taiwanese population to allow just a small, tiny number, in the larger picture of things, a tiny number of migrant workers that would help us immensely is not a worthy price to pay. What we should do instead is educate the public on how much they're doing for us, and skin color does not matter.
And before we go this week, the National Taxation Bureau of the Northern Area on Tuesday announced that it's withdrawn an award for the Uniform Invoice Lottery after it was deemed that the winning individual resorted to what is being termed as improper receipt collection. According to the Bureau, the individual deliberately purchased large numbers of cheap items from online stores to increase the number of receipts received, thus increasing the probability of winning the invoice lottery. The person reportedly obtained over 10,000 digital invoices from between May of last year and February of this year, and over that time period won a total of 30,000 NT. Now, the Bureau says the monetary award was withdrawn after an investigation found the purchased items did not fit regular consumption patterns and violated related lottery regulations. Now, the individual has since returned the winnings, but the Taxation Bureau is warning the public that all invoices must be collected through regular consumption. So, Michael, put your legal hat on, mate. Now, if this was me that got busted for doing this, and I said, right, you're my lawyer, tell them I love to buy my toothbrushes individually, in bulk, would that be a good defence?
Probably not. A new rule came into effect a couple years ago to address this kind of scamming of the invoice prize system by making thousands of very small purchases and collecting the invoices to therefore increase your chances of winning. And so they made a rule that said that you can only win prizes for uniform invoices that you receive in the course of normal consumption behavior. So in your case, what we would use is what we like to call an objective standard. We would say that, okay, you may subjectively like to buy your toothbrushes individually in great numbers, but most people looking at this objectively would say that this is not really normal consumer behavior. Therefore, your uniform invoices are disqualified from the prize. So, case dismissed.
I obviously won't be hiring Michael as my lawyer. Sean?
I think I have a scheme where I'll buy individual toothpicks for one NT, and then we'll just have millions. No, of course, that's not going to work, right? They're going to know I'm trying to game the system. But the amount of time you'll take to compare if it was paper receipts would be so hugely wasteful. And then if you use digital ones, I mean, this is kind of a joke, right? I mean, over 10,000 invoices, people have tried to do the scam in the past before. Like, I think there was a scheme last year or the year before that where some guy used anomalous shipping charges or what have you to amass a huge number in hoping to win small amounts here and there. At the same time, you could use this effort to actually, I don't know, do something, you know, like in a normal job, and you probably get the same amount of money. But if you have unlimited time in your hands, then I guess somebody might try this. And I think in this case, they were probably winning like, you know, 200 NT dollars. Like 200 NT dollars is like the common award that many people get, right? So 200 here, 200 there, you know, a small amount of money, and he was just, you know, banking all of this. And then suddenly, he won 30,000 NT, you know, or 30,000, like 1 million NT. Then, of course, he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I've earned it. I need to get this money. But I think this has been a grift, and he's just got caught.
This reminds me a little bit of a number of years ago, a woman got famous for some kind of really complicated scheme to bilk the credit card companies with credit card points and stuff. And I felt that the public, you know, she got in trouble for this, but she also got famous as a result. And I think the public admired her wit, her, you know, canniness to be able to see a way to grift the system in this way. And I suspect it's the same thing with these uniform invoice numbers. There was a case a few years ago where somebody did the same thing and did win, I don't know, 100,000 NT or something. And that's why they had the new regulation. The one thing I want to point out about the new regulation that I think is funny is that they have a clause at the end of the new rule which says that the methods they use to detect these patterns of unusual purchases and prize winning are strictly forbidden to be disclosed. So obviously there's a state secret how they prevent this.
Oh yeah. I mean, Taiwan is like number 3 when PISA ranking scores. You got lots of people that are great at math. They're going to find a way. If you put a hard line onto this, I was going to get to that. If you put a hard line onto this, they will find a way to skirt the rules and be right next to it. I mean, Taiwan is a nation that is sort of infamous for tax avoidance schemes and what have you, unfortunately. They will, if you put a hard line and hard specifications on what defines breaking the rules, you'll see somebody get within 0.1% of that just to maximize.
Right. Well, I had in mind that maybe they're using AI or something like that to detect patterns. And then if you knew what AI standards would be using, you might be able to use AI against it to trick the, but something like that.
Then you could actually use it to find out which parts of the country win most of the big prizes and which convenience store chain wins most of the big prizes and on what street that convenience store chain is on.
All of this for anyone listening to the program who's new to Taiwan, maybe the takeaway that you should have from all of this is that this business of the uniform invoice prizes is something of a national obsession. I mean, in the old days, before we had the electronic ones, you know, many families would gather around the table on, like, at the end of the month with shoeboxes full of these invoices. And it was like, it was great fun to go through all of them and check the numbers and you know, a great family activity. People love these prizes and take them very seriously.
I'd like to point out one of the earliest, most used apps in Taiwan that ever came out for the iPhone was indeed to check the receipt lottery. So you would just enter in the last three digits or four digits, and then it would tell you it was a potential winner or not. And people would just spend time, you know, entering in one receipt after another, you know, just to see if they won a small amount of you know, pitiful amount of money here. You know, and of course, the point of the receipt lottery is not the lottery itself. It's to collect tax earnings. That's the purpose of it. So it's not supposed to, you know, it's not really meant for like, okay, I'm going to, you know, win a huge amount of money by game. No, that's not it. It's
oh, no, really, it's a brilliant program because in the decades ago, of course, most businesses did not want to pay VAT, so they did not issue invoices.
Yep.
But by creating this lottery program, it caused consumers to demand from merchants that they issue those uniform invoice numbers.
Yes.
And slowly, the amount of receipts and the level of collection increased. It was brilliant public policy and fun.
And I've just got to ask, what's the most you've ever won on one receipt?
500 NT.
Sean?
I think I've won. I actually, you know what? I have to be honest. I used to compare those receipts and I would win like 200 here, 500 there. But then I just kind of gave up because I realized it wasn't worth the time. So now I just use the unified digital one. I don't even look at it. I'm so sorry. I'm one of those people that are not excited about that. So, to be a
doubter. But you don't check your digital ones?
No, I just don't. They don't have the time to do that.
But it takes a second. You go to IBAN or that's the whole point of using the appliances to get your invoice numbers so that you can instantly check your winnings. I never checked mine before until I could do it instantly electronically. Now I do it every month. I look forward to it.
I did the paper one for two, so every 2 months they do the lottery, right? And I did it for, I guess, two times over the course of 4 months. Then it was like, what am I doing sitting in this pile of papers? And I just never bothered touching it again.
Yeah. So you want to exclusively get the electronic ones or put them on your Yoyo card and then check them instantly.
I do have Zaiju and I have it on my phone and then I guess they scan it, but I actually never bothered to check it. I just feel like 200 NT, 500 NT is great. I mean, who knows? Maybe I won the lottery, but no, I don't think so. I don't really care. It's just not my cup of tea. However, I do know for the vast majority of Taiwanese, that's a very important part of their lives.
So I think the takeaway here is if you happen to be in a convenience store or a supermarket, standing behind either Michael or Sean, get them to give you your receipts, and you might win.
You're not getting mine.
Oh yeah, I honestly. Oh yeah, but you go to any parking lot in Taiwan, right? You see, like, you ever reach in, and there's like a dozen of them in there, right? It's just completely littered because people don't bother grabbing them. Sometimes, yeah, the digital one is much better. But man, I don't know how I'd feel if you were there, standing in front of me at 7-Eleven, buying every toothbrush and item individually, one at a time. Oh my God! Please don't do that to me.
That can be arranged. Anyway, that's where we'll leave it here this week on Taiwan This Week. And I've been joined in the studio today by Michael Fahey.
Take care, everyone.
And by Sean Su.
All right, thanks for everything.
And thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Taiwan This Week here on ICRT with me, Gavin Phipps. And don't forget to check out Taiwan This Week podcast on your favourite podcast platform where you can get access to all our previous shows.
Tune in again next Friday evening at 9 for another informative look at the top stories of the week with Taiwan This Week. And don't forget to also check out our podcast on our website, icrt.com.tw. Now keep it here for more music and news only on ICRT FM 100.